Track 4.
Samantha had never known a man like this. He filled her with a sense of awe. It was not only the legend that surrounded him, nor the formidable list of his accomplishments that Angel had recounted for her, nor yet was it only the physical strength which he had just demonstrated while the entire crew of Warlock, she among them, had watched and listened avidly over the VHF relay. She leaned over him again, and she saw that even in repose, his jawline was hard and uncompromising, and the little creases and lines and marks that life had chiseled into his face, around the eyes and at the corners of the mouth, heightened the effect of power and determination, the face of a man who dictated his own terms to life. She wanted him. Angel was right. Oh, God, how she wanted him. They said there was no love at first sight. They had to be mad. She turned away and unfolded the eiderdown from the foot of the bunk, spreading it over him. And then once again, she stooped and gently lifted the fall of thick dark hair from his forehead, smoothing it back with a maternally protective gesture. Although he had slept on while she lifted and covered him, strangely, this lightest of touches brought him to the edge of consciousness, and he sighed and twisted, then whispered hoarsely, "Chantal, is that you?" Samantha recoiled at the bitter, sharp pang of jealousy which another woman's name stabbed her. She turned away and left him, but in the day cabin she paused again beside his desk. There were a few small personal items thrown carelessly onto the leather-bound blotter. A gold money clip, holding a mixed sheath of currency notes, £5 sterling, $50 US, Deutschmarks and francs. A gold Rolex Oyster perpetual watch, a gold Dunhill lighter with a single white diamond set in it, and a billfold of the smoothest, finest calf leather. They described clearly the man who owned them, and feeling like a thief, she picked up the billfold and opened it. There were a dozen cards in their little plastic envelopes. American Express, Diners, Bank American, Carte Blanche, Hertz No. 1, Pan Am VIP, and the rest. But opposite them was a color photograph. Three people. A man, Nicholas, in a cable-stitched jersey, his face bronzed, his hair wind-ruffled. A small boy in a yachting jacket with a curly mop of hair and solemn eyes above a smiling mouth. And a woman. She was probably one of the most beautiful women Samantha had ever seen. And she closed the billfold, replaced it carefully, and quietly left the cabin. David Allen called the captain's suite for 3 minutes without an answer, slapping his open palm on the mahogany chart table with impatience and staring through the navigation windows at the spectacle of a world gone mad. For almost 2 hours, the wind had blown steadily from the northwest at a little over 30 knots, and although the big lumpy seas still tumbled into the mouth of the bay, Warlock had ridden them easily, even connected as she was to Golden Adventurer by the main tow cable. David had put a messenger over the liner's stern, firing the nylon line from a rocket gun. And Baker's men had retrieved the line and winched across the first carrier wire and then the main cable itself. Warlock had let the main cable be drawn out of her by Adventurer's winches, slowly revolving off the great winch drums in the compartment under the tug's stern deck, out through the cable ports below the after navigation bridge, where David stood controlling each inch of run and play with light touches on the controls. A good man could work that massive cable like a fly fisherman playing a big salmon in the turbulent water of a mountain torrent. Letting it slip against the clutch plates or run free or recover slack, bringing it up hard and fast under a pull of 500 tons. Or, in dire emergency, he could hit the shear button and snip through the flexible steel wire, instantaneously relinquishing the tow, possibly saving the tug itself from being pulled under or being rushed by the vessel it was towing. It had taken an hour of delicate work, but now the tow was in place. A double yoke, made fast to Golden Adventurer's main deck bollards, one on her starboard and one on her port stern quarters. The yoke was Y-shaped, drooping over the high stern to join at the white nylon spring, three times the thickness of a man's thigh, and with the elasticity to absorb sudden shock, which might have snapped rigid steel cable. From the yoke connection, the single main cable looped back to the tug. David Allen was lying back 1,000 yards from the shore, holding enough strain on the tow cable to prevent it sagging to touch and possibly snag on the unknown bottom. He was holding his station, with gentle play, on the pitch and power of the twin screws, and checking his exact position against the electronic dials, which gave him his speed across the ground in both directions, accurate to within a foot a minute. It was all nicely under control, and every time he glanced up at the liner, the discharge of water still boiled from her pump outlets. Half an hour previously, he had been able to contain his impatience, for he knew with a seaman's deep instinct what was coming down upon them out of the dangerous quadrant of the wind. He had called Baker to ask how the work on the liner was progressing. It had been a mistake. "You've got nothing better to do than call me out of the engine room to ask about my piles and the FA Cup final? I'll tell you when I'm ready. Believe me, Sonny, I'll call you. If you're bored, go down and give Angel a kiss. But for God's sake, leave me alone." Beauty Baker was working with two of his men in that filthy, freezing steel box deep down in the liner's stern that housed the emergency steering gear. The rudder was right across at full port lock. Unless he could get power on the steering machinery, she would be almost unmanageable once she was under tow, especially if she was pulled off stern first. It was vital that the big ship was responding to her helm when Warlock tried to haul her off. Baker cursed and cajoled the greasy machinery, knocking loose a flap of thick white skin from his knuckles when a spanner slipped, but worked on grimly without even bothering to lift the injury to his mouth to suck away the welling blood. He let it drop onto the spanner and thicken into a sticky jelly, swearing softly but viciously, as he concentrated all his skills on the obdurate steel mass of the steering gear. He knew every bit as well as the first officer what was coming down upon them. The wind had dropped to a gentle force 4, a moderate, steady breeze that blew for 20 minutes, just long enough for the crests of the waves to stop breaking over on themselves. Then slowly it veered north, and without any further warning, it was upon them. It came roaring like a ravening beast, lifting the surface of the sea away in white sheets of spray that looked as though red-hot steel had been quenched in it. It laid Warlock right over, so that her port rail went under, and she was flung up so harshly on her main cable that her stern was pulled down sharply, water pouring in through her stern scuppers. It took David by surprise, so that she paid off dangerously before he could slam open the port throttle and throw the starboard screw into full reverse thrust. As she came up, he hit the call to the captain's suite, watching with rising disbelief as the mad world dissolved around him. Nick heard the call from far away. It only just penetrated to his fatigue-drugged brain, and he tried to respond. But it felt as though his body was crushed under an enormous weight, and that his brain was slow and sluggish as a hibernating reptile. The buzzer insisted. A tinny, nagging whine, and he tried to force his eyes open, but they were not to respond. Then dimly, but deeply, he felt the wild, anguished action of his ship, and the tumult that he believed at first was in his own ears, but was the violent uproar of the storm about the tug's superstructure. He forced himself up on one elbow, and his body ached in every joint. He still could not open his eyes, but he groped for the handset. "Captain, to the after bridge." He could hear something in David Allen's voice that forced him to his feet. When Nick staggered on to the after navigation bridge, the first officer turned gratefully to him. "Thank God you've come, sir." The wind had taken the surface off the sea, had stripped it away, tearing each wave to a shrieking fog of white spray and mingling it with the sleet and snow that drove horizontally across the bay. Nick glanced once at the dial of the wind anemometer and then discounted the reading. The needle was stuck at the top of the scale. It made no sense. A wind speed of 120 miles an hour was too much to accept. The instrument had been damaged by the initial gusts of this wind, and he refused to believe it. To do so now would be to admit disaster, for nobody could salvage an ocean-going liner in wind velocities right off the Beaufort scale. Warlock stood on her tail, like a performing dolphin begging for a meal, as the cable brought her up short and the bridge deck became a vertical cliff down which Nick was hurled. He crashed into the control panel and clung for purchase to the foul weather rail. "We'll have to shear the cable and stand out to sea." David Allen's voice was pitched too high and too loud, even for the tumult of the wind and the storm. There were men on board Golden Adventurer, Baker and 16 others, Nick thought swiftly, and even her twin anchors could not be trusted to hold in this. Nick clung to the rail and peered out into the storm. Frozen spray and sleet and impacted snow drove on the wind, coming in with the force of buckshot fired at point-blank range, cracking into the armored glass of the bridge and building up in thick clots and lumps that defeated the efforts of the spinning, clear vision panels. He looked across 1,000 yards, and the hull of the liner was just visible, a denser area in the howling, swirling, white wilderness. "Baker," he asked into the hand microphone, "what is your position?" "The wind's got her. She's slewing. The starboard anchor is dragging." And then, while Nick thought swiftly, "You'll not be able to take us off in this." It was a flat statement, an acceptance of the fact that the destinies of Baker and his 16 men were inexorably linked to that of the doomed ship. "No," Nick agreed. "We won't be able to get you off." To approach the stricken ship was certain disaster for all of them. "Shear the cable and stand off," Baker advised. "We'll try to get ashore if she breaks up." Then, with a hangman's chuckle, he went on, "Just don't forget to come and fetch us when the weather moderates. That is, if there's anybody to fetch." Abruptly, Nick's anger came to the surface through the layers of fatigue, anger at the knowledge that all he'd risked and suffered was now to be in vain, that he was to lose Golden Adventurer, and probably with her 16 men, one of whom had become a friend. "Are you ready to heave on the anchor winches?" he asked. "We're going to pull the bitch off." "Jesus," said Baker. "She's still half flooded." "We will have to lash at it, Cobber," said Nick quietly. The steering gear is locked. You won't be able to control her. You'll lose Warlock as well as... But Nicholas cut Baker short. Listen, you stupid Queensland sheep shagger. Get onto those winches. As he said it, Golden Adventurer disappeared, her bulk blotted out completely by the solid white curtains of the blizzard. Engine room? Nick spoke crisply to the second engineer. Disengage the override and give me direct control of both power and pitch. Control transfer to bridge, sir, the engineer confirmed. And Nick touched the shining stainless steel levers with fingers as sensitive as those of a concert pianist. Warlock's response was instantaneous. She pivoted, shrugging aside a green, slithering burst of water, which came in over her shoulder and thundered down the side of her superstructure. Anchor winches manned. Beauty Baker's tone was almost casual. Stand by, said Nick, and felt his way through that white inferno. It was impossible to maintain a visual reference. The entire world was white and swirling. Even the surface of the sea was gone in torn streamers of white. The very pull of gravity that should have defined even a simple up or down was confused by the violent pitch and roll of the deck. Nick felt his exhausted brain begin to lurch dizzily in the first attacks of vertigo. Swiftly, he switched his attention to the big compass and the heading indicator. David, he said, take the wheel. He wanted somebody swift and bright at the helm now. Warlock plunged suddenly, so viciously, that Nick's bruised ribs were brought in brutal contact with the edge of the control console. He grunted involuntarily with the pain. Warlock was feeling her cable. She had come up hard. Starboard 10, said Nick to David, bringing her bows up into that hideous wind. Chief, he spoke into the microphone, his voice still ragged with the pain in his chest. Haul starboard winch. Full power. Full power starboard. Nick slid pitch control to fully fine, and then slowly nudged open the throttles, bringing in 22,000 horsepower. Held by her tail, driven by the great wind, and tortured by the sea, lashed by her own enormous propellers, Warlock went berserk. She corkscrewed and porpoised to her very limits. Every frame in her hull shook with the vibration of her screws as her propellers burst out of the surface and spun wildly in the air. Nick had to clench his jaws as the vibration threatened to crack his teeth, and when he glanced across at the forward and lateral speed indicators, he saw that David Allen's face was icy white and set like that of a corpse. Warlock was slewing down on the wind, describing a slow left-hand circle at the limit of the cable as the engine torque and the wind took her round. Starboard 20, Nick snapped, correcting the turn. And despite the rigor of his features, David Allen's response was instantaneous. 20 degrees of starboard wheel answer. Nick saw the lateral drift stop on the ground speed indicator, and then, with a wild lurch of elation, he saw the forward speed indicator flicked into green. Its electronic digital read out, changing swiftly. They were moving forward at 150 feet a minute. We are moving her, Nick cried aloud, and he snatched up the microphone. Full power, both winches. Both full and holding, answered Baker immediately. And Nick glanced back at the forward speed across the ground. 150, 110, 75 feet a minute. Warlock's forward impetus was slowed, and Nick realized with a slide of dismay that it was merely the elasticity of the nylon spring that had given them that reading. The spring was stretching out to its limit. For 2 or 3 seconds, the dial recorded a zero rate of speed. Warlock was standing still, the cable drawn out to the full limit of her strength. Then, abruptly, the dial flicked into vivid red. They were going backwards, as the nylon spring exerted pressures beyond that of the two diesels and the big bronze screws. Warlock was being dragged back towards that dreadful shore. For another 5 minutes, Nick kept both clenched fists on the control levers, pressing them with all his strength to the limit of their travel, sending the great engines shrieking, driving the needles up around the dials, deep into the red, never-exceed sectors. He felt tears of anger and frustration scalding his swollen eyelids, and the ship shuddered and shook and screamed under him, her torment transmitted through the soles of his feet and the palms of his hands. Warlock was held down by cable and power, so she could not rise to meet the seas that came out of the roaring whiteness. They tumbled aboard her, piling up on each other, so she burrowed deeper and more dangerously. "For God's sake, sir!" David Allen was no longer able to contain himself. His eyes looked huge in his bone-white face. "You'll drive her clean under." "Baker?" Nick ignored his mate. "Are you gaining?" "No recovery either winch," Beauty told him. "She's not moving." Nick pulled back the stainless steel levers. The needles sank swiftly back around their dials, and Warlock reacted gratefully, shaking herself free of the piled waters. "We'll have to shear the tow." Baker's disembodied voice was muted by the clamor of the storm. "We'll take our chances, sport." Beside him, David Allen reached for the red-painted steel box that housed the shear button. It was protected by the box from accidental usage. David Allen opened the box and looked expectantly, almost pleadingly, at Nick.
"Belay that!"
Nick snarled at him, and then to Baker. "I'm shortening tow. Be ready to haul again when I'm in position." David Allen stared at him, his right hand still on the open lid of the red box. "Close that bloody thing," Nick said, and turned to the main cable controls. He moved the green lever to reverse and felt the vibration in the deck as below him in the main cable room the big drums began to revolve, drawing the thick, ice-encrusted cable up over Warlock's stern. Fighting every inch of the way like a wild horse on a head halter, Warlock was drawn in cautiously by her own winches, and the officers watched in mounting horror as out of the white terror of the blizzard emerged the mountainous, ice-covered bulk of Golden Adventurer. She was so close that the main cable no longer dipped below the surface of the sea, but ran directly from the liner's stern to the tug's massive fairlees on her stern quarter. "Now we can see what we're doing," Nick told them grimly. He could see now that much of Warlock's power had been wasted by not exerting a pull on exactly the same plane as Golden Adventurer's keel. He had been disorientated in the whiteout of the blizzard and had allowed Warlock to pull at an angle. It would not happen now. "Chief," he said, "pull. Pull all. Pull until she bursts her guts." And again he slid the throttle handles fully home. Warlock flung up against the elastic yoke, and Nick saw the water spurt from the woven fibers and turn instantly to ice crystals as it was whipped away in the shrieking wind. "She's not moving, sir," David cried beside him. "No recovery either winch," Baker confirmed almost immediately. "She's solid." "Too much water still in her," said David, and Nick turned on him as though to strike him to the deck.
"Give me the wheel," he said,
his voice cracking with his anger and frustration. With both engines boiling the sea to white foam and roaring like dying bulls, Nick swung the wheel to full port lock. Wildly, Warlock dug her shoulder in. Water pouring on board her as she rolled. Instantly, Nick spun the wheel to full starboard lock, and she lurched against the tow, throwing an extra ton of pressure onto it. Even above the storm, they heard Golden Adventurer groan, the steel of her hull protesting at the weight of water in her and the intolerable pressure of the anchor winches and the Warlock's tow cable. The groan became a crackling hiss as the pebble bottom gave and moved under her.
"Christ! She's coming!" shrieked Baker.
And Nick swung her to full port lock again, swinging Warlock into a deep trough between the waves. Then a solid ridge of steaming water buried her, and Nick was not certain she could survive that press of furious sea. It came green and slick over the superstructure, and she shuddered wearily, gone slow and unwieldy. Then she lifted her bows, and like a spaniel, shook herself free, becoming again quick and light.
"Pull, my darling, pull,"
Nick pleaded with her. With a slow, reluctant rumble, Golden Adventurer's hull began to slide over the holding, clinging bottom.
"Both winches recovering,"
Baker howled gleefully, and Warlock's ground speed indicator flicked into green, its little angular figures changing in twinkling electronic progression as Warlock gathered way. They all saw Golden Adventurer's stern swinging to meet the next great ridge of water as it burst around her. She was floating, and for moments Nick was paralyzed by the wonder of seeing that great and beautiful ship come to life again, become a living, vital sea creature as she took the seas and rose to meet them.
"We've done it, Christ! We've done it!"
howled Baker. But it was too soon for self-congratulation. As Golden Adventurer came free of the ground and gathered sternway under Warlock's tow, so her rudder bit and swung her tall stern across the wind. She swung, exposing the enormous windage of her starboard side to the full force of the storm. It was like setting a mainsail, and the wind took her down swiftly on the rocky headland with its sentinel columns that guarded the entrance to the bay. Nick's first instinct was to try and hold her off, to oppose the force of the wind directly, and he flung Warlock into the task, relying on her great diesels and the two anchors to keep the liner from going ashore again. But the wind toyed with them. It ripped the anchors out of the pebble bottom, and Warlock was drawn stern first through the water, straight down on the jagged rock of the headland.
"Chief, get those anchors up,"
Nick snapped into the microphone. "They'll never hold in this." 20 years earlier, bathing off a lonely beach in the Seychelles, Nick had been caught out of his depth by one of those killer currents that flow around the headlands of oceanic islands, and had sped him out into the open sea, so that within minutes the silhouette of the land was low and indistinct on his watery horizon. He had fought that current, swimming directly against it, and it had nearly killed him. Only in the last stages of exhaustion had he begun to think, and instead of battling it, he had ridden the current, angling slowly across it, using its impetus rather than opposing it. The lesson he had learned that day was well remembered, and as he watched Baker bring Golden Adventurer's dripping anchors out of the wild water, he was driving Warlock hard, bringing her around on her cable so that the wind was no longer in her teeth but over her stern quarter. Now the wind and Warlock's screws were no longer opposed, but Warlock was pulling 2 points off the wind, as fine a course as Nick could judge, barely to clear the most seaward of the rocky sentinels. Now the liner's locked rudder was holding her steady into the wind, but opposing Warlock's attempt to angle her away from the land. It was a problem of simple vectors of force, that Nick tried to work out in his head and prove in physical terms, as he delicately judged the angle of his toe and the direction of the wind, balancing them against the tremendous leverage of the liner's locked rudder, the rudder which was dragging her suicidally down upon the land. Grimly, he stared ahead to where the black rock cliffs were still hidden in the white nothingness. They were invisible, but their presence was recorded on the cluttered screen of the radar repeater. With both wind and engines driving them, their speed was too high, and if Golden Adventurer went onto the cliffs like this, her hull would shatter like a watermelon hurled against a brick wall. It was another 5 minutes before Nick was absolutely certain that they would not make it. They were only 2 miles off the cliffs now. He glanced again at the radar screen. And they would have to drag Golden Adventurer at least half a mile across the wind to clear the land. They just were not going to make it. Helplessly, Nick stood and peered into the storm, waiting for the first glimpse of black rock through the swirling eddies of snow and frozen spray. And he had never felt more tired and unmanned in his entire life, as he moved to the shear button, ready to cut Golden Adventurer loose and let her go to her doom. His officers were silent and tense around him, while under his feet Warlock shuddered and buffeted wildly, driven to her mortal limits by the sea and her own engines. But still, the land sucked at them. "Look!" David Allen shouted suddenly, and Nick spun to the urgency in his voice. For a moment, he did not understand what was happening. He knew only that the shape of Golden Adventurer's stern was altered subtly. "The rudder!" shouted David Allen again. And Nick saw it revolving slowly on its stock as the ship lifted on another big sea. Almost immediately, he felt Warlock making offing from under the lee shore, and he swung her up another point into the wind, Golden Adventurer answering her tow with a more docile air, and still the rudder revolved slowly. "I've got power on the emergency steering gear now," said Baker. "Rudder amidships," Nick ordered. "Amidships it is," Baker repeated. And now he was pulling her out stern first, almost at right angles across the wind. Through the white inferno suddenly appeared the dim, snow-blurred outline of the rock sentinels, and the sea broke upon them like the thunder of the heavens. "God, they're close," whispered David Allen. So close that they could feel the backlash of the gale as it rebounded from the tall rock walls, moderating the tremendous force that was bearing them down, moderating just enough to allow them to slide past the three hungry rocks. And before them lay 3,000 miles of wild and tumultuous water, all of it open sea room. "We made it. This time we really made it," said Baker, as though he did not believe it was true. And Nick pulled back the throttle controls, taking the intolerable strain of her engines before they tore themselves to pieces. "Anchors and all," Nick replied. It was a point of honor to retrieve even the anchors. They had taken her off clean and intact, anchors and all. "Chief," he said, "instead of sitting there hugging yourself, how about pumping her full of Tanaracks?" The anti-corrosive chemical would save her engines and much of her vital equipment from further seawater damage, adding enormously to her salvaged value. "You just never let up, do you?" Baker answered accusingly. "Don't you believe it," said Nick. He felt stupid and frivolous with exhaustion and triumph. Even the storm that still roared about them seemed to have lost its murderous intensity. "Right now, I'm going down to my bunk to sleep for 12 hours, and I'll kill anybody who tries to wake me. He hung the hand mic on its bracket and put his hand on David Allen's shoulder. He squeezed once and said, "You did well. You did very well. Take her, number one, and look after her." Then he stumbled from the bridge. It was 8 days before they saw the land again. They rode out the storm in the open sea. 8 days of unrelenting tension and heartbreaking labor. The first task was to move the tow cable to Golden Adventurer's bows. In that sea, the transfer took almost 24 hours, and 3 abortive attempts before they had her head on to the wind. Now she rode more easily, and Warlock had merely to hang on like a drogue, using full power only when one of the big icebergs came within dangerous range and it was necessary to draw her off. However, the tension was always there, and Nick spent most of those days on the bridge, watchful and worried, nagged by the fear that the plug in the gashed hull would not hold. Baker used timbers from the ship's store to shore up the temporary patch, but he could not put steel in place while Golden Adventurer plunged and rolled in the heavy seas, and Nick could not go aboard to check and supervise the work. Slowly, the great wheel of low pressure revolved over them. The winds changed direction, backing steadily into the west as the epicenter marched on down the sea lane towards Australasia, and at last it had passed. Now Warlock could work up towing speed. Even in those towering glassy swells of black water that the storm had left them as a legacy, she was able to make 4 knots. Then, one clear and windy morning, under a cold yellow sun, she brought Golden Adventurer into the sheltered waters of Shackleton Bay. It was like a diminutive guide dog leading a blinded colossus. As the two ships came up into the still waters under the sheltering arm of the bay, the survivors came down from their encampment to the water's edge, lining the steep black pebble beach, and their cheers and shouts of welcome and relief carried thinly on the wind to the officers on Warlock's bridge. Even before the liner's twin anchors splashed into the clear green water, Captain Riley's boat was puttering out to Warlock, and when he came aboard, his eyes were haunted by the hardship and difficulties of those last days, by the disaster of a lost command and the lives that had been ended with it. But when he shook hands with Nick, his grasp was firm. "My thanks and congratulations, sir." He had known Nicholas Berg as chairman of Christie Marine, and as no other, he was aware of the magnitude of this, his most recent accomplishment. His respect was apparent. "It's good to see you again," Nick told him. "Naturally, you have access to my ship's communications to report to your owners." Immediately, he turned back to the task of maneuvering Warlock alongside, so that steel plate could be swung up from her salvage holds to the liner's deck. It was another hour before Captain Riley emerged from the radio room. "Can I offer you a drink, Captain?" Nick led him to his day cabin, and began with tact to deal with the 100 details which had to be settled between them. It was a delicate situation, for Riley was no longer master of his own ship. Command had passed to Nicholas as salvage master. "The accommodation aboard Golden Adventure is still quite serviceable, and, I imagine, a great deal warmer and more comfortable than that occupied by your passengers at present." Nick made it easier for him, while never for a moment letting him lose sight of his command position, and Riley responded gratefully. Within half an hour, They had made all the necessary arrangements to transfer the survivors aboard the liner. Le Voisin on Lamouette had been able to take only 120 supernumeraries on board his little tug. The oldest and weakest of them had gone, and Christa Marine was negotiating for a charter from Cape Town to Shackleton Bay to take off the rest of them. Now that charter was unnecessary, but the cost of it would form part of Nick's claim for salvage award. I won't take more of your time. Riley drained his glass and stood. You have much to do. There were another 4 days and nights of hard work. Nick went aboard Golden Adventurer and saw the cavernous engine room lit by the eye-scorching blue glare of the electric welding flames, as Baker placed his steel over the wound and welded it into place. Even then, neither he nor Nick were satisfied until the new patches had been shored and stiffened with baulks of heavy timber. There was a hard passage through the roaring forties ahead of them, and until they had Golden Adventurer safely moored in Cape Town docks, the salvage was incomplete. They sat side by side among the greasy machinery and the stink of the anti-corrosives, and drank steaming thermos coffee laced with Bundaberg rum. "We get this beauty into Duncan Docks, and you're going to be a rich man," Nick said. "I've been rich before. With me it never lasts long, and it's always a relief when I've spent the stuff." Beauty gargled the rum and coffee appreciatively before he went on shrewdly. So you don't have to worry about losing the best goddamned engineer afloat. Nick laughed with delight. Baker had read him accurately. He did not want to lose this man. Nick left him and went to see to the trim of the liner, studying her carefully and using the experience of the last days to determine her best points of tow, before giving orders to David Allen to raise her slightly by the head. Then there was the transfer from the liner's bunkers of sufficient bunker oil to top up Warlock's own tanks against the long tow ahead. And Bach Wacky in Bermuda kept the telex clattering with relays from underwriters and Lloyds, with the first tentative advances from Christy Marine. Already Duncan Alexander was trying out the angles, manoeuvring for a liberal settlement of Nick's claims, without, as he put it, the expense of the arbitration court. "Tell him I'm going to roast him," Nick answered with grim relish. "Remind him that as chairman of Christy Marine, I advised against underwriting our own bottoms, and now I'm going to rub his nose in it." The days and nights blurred together, the illusion made complete by the imbalance of time down here in the high latitudes, so that Nick could often believe neither his senses nor his watch when he'd been working 18 hours straight, and yet the sun still burned, and his watch told him it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Then again, it did not seem part of reality when his senior officers, gathered around the mahogany table in his day cabin, reported that the work was completed, the repairs and preparation, the loading of fuel, the embarkation of passengers, and the 100 other details had all been attended to, and Warlock was ready to drag her massive charge out into that unpredictable sea, thousands of miles to the southernmost tip of Africa. Nick passed the cheroot box around the circle, and while the blue smoke clouded the cabin, he allowed them all a few minutes to luxuriate in the feeling of work done and done well. "We'll rest the ship's company for 24 hours, he announced in a rush of generosity, "and take in tow at 8 hours Monday. I'm hoping for a tow speed of 6 knots. 21 days to Cape Town, gentlemen. When they rose to leave, David Allen lingered self-consciously. The wardroom is arranging a little Christmas celebration tonight, sir, and we would like you to be our guest. The wardroom was the junior officers' club, from which, traditionally, the master was excluded. He could enter the small paneled cabin only as an invited guest. But there was no doubt at all about the genuine warmth of the welcome they gave him. Even the Trog was there. They stood and applauded him when he entered, and it was clear that most of them had made an early start on the gin. David Allen made a speech, which he read haltingly from a scrap of paper, which he tried to conceal in the palm of one hand. It was a speech full of hyperbole, clichés and superlatives, and he was clearly mightily relieved once it was over. Then Angel brought in a cake he had baked for the occasion. It was iced in the shape of Golden Adventurer, a minor work of art, with the figures 12.5% picked out in gold on its hull, and they applauded him. That 12.5% had significance to set them all grinning and exclaiming. Then they called on Nick to speak, and his style was relaxed and easy. He had them hooting with glee within minutes, a mere mention of the prize money that would be due to them once they brought Golden Adventurer into Cape Town had them in ecstasy. The girl was wedged into a corner, almost swallowed in the knot of young officers, who found it necessary to press as closely around her as possible, without actually smothering her. She laughed with a clear, unaffected exuberance, her voice ringing high above the growl of masculine mirth, so that Nick found it difficult not to keep looking across at her. She wore a dress of green clinging material, and Nick wondered where it had come from, until he remembered that Golden Adventurer's passenger accommodation was intact, and that earlier that morning he had noticed the girl standing beside David Allen in the stern of the workboat, as it returned from the liner, with a large suitcase at her feet. She had been to fetch her gear, and she probably should have stayed aboard the liner. Nick was pleased she had not. Nick finished his little speech, having mentioned every one of his officers by name, and given to each the praise they deserved. And David Allen pressed another large whiskey into one hand and an inelegant wedge of cake into the other, and then left hurriedly to join the tight circle around the girl. It opened reluctantly, yielding to his seniority, and Nick found himself almost deserted. He watched with indulgence the open competition for her attention. She was shorter than any of them, so Nick saw only the top of that magnificent mane of sun-streaked hair, hair the colour of precious metal, that shone as she nodded and tilted her head, catching the overhead lights. Beauty Baker was on one side of her, dressed in a ready-made suit of shiny imitation shark skin, that made a startling contrast to his plaid shirt and acid yellow tie. The trousers of the suit needed hoisting every few minutes, and his spectacles glittered lustfully as he hung over the girl. David Allen was close on her other side, blushing pinkly every time she turned to speak to him, plying her with cake and liquor, and Nick found his indulgence turning to irritation. He was irritated by the presence of a tongue-tied fourth officer, who had clearly been delegated to entertain him, and was completely awed by the responsibility. He was irritated by the antics of his senior officers. They were behaving like a troop of performing seals in their competition for the girl's attention. For a few moments, the tight circle around her opened, and Nick was left with a few vivid impressions. The green of her dress matched exactly the brilliant, sparkling green of her eyes. Her teeth were very white, and her tongue as pink as a cat's when she laughed. She was not the child he'd imagined from their earlier encounters. With colour touched to her lips and pearls at her throat, he realized she was in her 20s. Early 20s, perhaps, but a full woman, nevertheless. She looked across the wardroom and their eyes met. The laughter stilled on her lips, and she returned his gaze. It was a solemn, enigmatic gaze, and he found himself once again regretting his previous rudeness to her. He dropped his gaze from hers and saw now that under the clinging green material, her body was slim and beautifully formed with a lithe, athletic grace. He remembered vividly that one new glimpse he'd been given. Although the green dress was high-necked, he saw that her breasts were large and pointed, that they were not trussed by any undergarments. The young, shapely flesh was as strikingly arresting as it had been naked. It made him angry to see her body displayed in this manner. It did not matter that every young girl in the streets of New York or London went so uncorseted. Here, it made him angry to see her do the same, and he looked back into her eyes. Something charged there, a challenge perhaps, his own anger reflected, he was not sure. She tilted her head slightly. Now it was an invitation, or was it? He had known and handled easily so many, many women. Yet this one left him with a feeling of uncertainty. Perhaps it was merely her youth, or was it some special quality she possessed? Nicholas Berg was uncertain, and he did not relish the feeling. David Allen hurried to her with another offering, and cut off the gaze that passed between them. And Nick found himself staring at the chief officer's slim, boyish back and listening to the girl's laughter again, sweet and high. But somehow it seemed to be directed tauntingly at Nick. And he said to the young officer beside him, "Please ask Mr. Allen for a moment of his time." Patently relieved, the officer went to fetch him. "Thank you for your hospitality, David," said Nick when he came. "You aren't going yet, sir." Nick took a small sadistic pleasure in the mate's obvious dismay. He sat at the desk in his day cabin and tried to concentrate. It was the first opportunity he'd had to consider the paperwork that awaited him. The muted sounds of revelry from the deck below distracted him, and he found himself listening for the sounds of her laughter, while he should have been composing his submission to his London attorneys, which would be taken to the arbitrators of Lloyd's, a document and record of vital importance, the whole basis of his claim against Golden Adventurer's underwriters. And yet he could not concentrate. He swung his chair away from the desk and began to pace the thick, sound-deadening carpet, stopping once to listen again as he heard the girl's voice calling gaily, the words unintelligible, but the tone unmistakable. They were dancing, or playing some raucous game which consisted of a great deal of bumping and thumping and shrieks of laughter. He began to pace again. And suddenly Nick realized he was lonely. The thought stopped him dead again. He was lonely and completely alone. It was a disturbing realization, especially for a man who had traveled much of life's journey as a loner. Before, it had never troubled him, but now he felt desperately the need for somebody to share his triumph. Triumph it was, of course. Against the most improbable odds, he had snatched spectacular victory. and he crossed slowly to the cabin portholes and looked across the darkened bay to where Golden Adventurer lay at anchor, all her lights burning, a gay and festive air about her. He had been knocked off his perch at the top of the tree, deprived of a life's work, a wife and a son. Yet it had taken him only a few short months to clamber back to the top. With this simple operation, he had transformed Ocean Salvage from a dangerously insecure venture, a tottering, cash-starved, problem-hounded long chance, into something of real value. He was off and running again now, with a place to go and the means of getting there. Then, why did it suddenly seem of so little worth? He toyed with the idea of returning to the revelry of the wardroom, and grimaced as he imagined the dismay of his officers at the master's inhibiting intrusion. He turned away from the porthole and poured whiskey into a glass, lit a cheroot, and dropped into the chair. The whiskey tasted like toothpaste, and the cheroot was bitter. He left the glass on his desk and stubbed the cheroot before he went through onto the navigation bridge. The night lights were so dim after his brightly lit cabin that he did not notice Graham, the third officer, until his eyes adjusted to the ruby glow. "Good evening, Mr. Graham." He moved to the chart table and checked the log. Graham was hovering anxiously, and Nick searched for something to say. "Missing the party?" he asked at last. "Sir?" It was not a promising conversational opening, and despite his loneliness a few minutes previously, Nick suddenly wanted to be alone again. "I'll stand the rest of your watch. Go off and enjoy yourself." The third officer gawped at him. "You've got 3 seconds before I change my mind." "That's jolly decent of you, sir," called Graham over his shoulder as he fled. The party in the wardroom had by now degenerated into open competition for Samantha's attention and approbation. David Allen, wearing a lampshade on his head, and for some unaccountable reason, with his right hand thrust into his jacket in a Napoleonic gesture, was standing on the wardroom bar counter and declaiming Henry's speech before Agincourt, glossing over the passages which he'd forgotten with a dum-de-de-dum. However, when Tim Graham entered, he became immediately the first officer. He removed the lampshade and inquired frostily, "Mr. Graham, am I correct in believing that you are officer of the watch? Your station at this moment is on the bridge." "The old man came and offered to stand my watch," said Tim Graham. "Good Lord." David replaced his lampshade and poured a large gin for his third officer. "The old bastard must have come over all soft suddenly." Beauty Baker, who was hanging off the wall like a gibbon ape, dropped to his feet and drew himself up with rather unsteady dignity, hitched his trousers, and announced ominously, "If anybody calls the old bastard a bastard, I will personally kick his teeth down his throat." He swept the wardroom with an eye that was belligerent and truculent until it alighted on Samantha. Immediately it softened. "That one doesn't count, Sammy," he said. "Of course not," Samantha agreed. "You can start again." Beauty returned to the starting point of the obstacle course, fortified himself with a draught of rum, pushed up his spectacles with a thumb and spat on his palms. "One to get ready, two to get steady, and three to be off, sang out Samantha, and clicked the stopwatch. Beauty Baker swung dizzily from the roof, clawing his way around the wardroom without touching the deck, cheered on by the entire company. 8.6 seconds. Samantha clicked the watch as he ended up on the bar counter, the finishing post, and a new world record. A drink for the new world champion. I'm next. Time me, Sammy. They were like schoolboys. Hey, watch me, Sammy. But after another 10 minutes, she handed the stopwatch to Tim Graham, who, as a late arrival, was still sober. I'll be back, she lied. Picked up a plate with a large, untouched hunk of angel's cake upon it, and it was gone before any of them realized it was happening. Nick Berg was working over the chart table, so intent that he was not aware of her for many seconds. In the dramatic lighting of the single overhead lamp, the strength of his features was emphasized. She saw the hard line of his jawbone, the heavy brow, and the alert, widely spaced set of his eyes. His nose was large and slightly hooked, like that of a plains Indian or a desert Bedouin, and there were lines at the corners of his mouth and around his eyes that were picked out in dark shadow. In his complete absorption with the charts and Admiralty Pilot, he had relaxed his mouth from its usual severe line. She saw now that the lips were full without being fleshy, and there was a certain sensitivity and voluptuousness there that she had not noticed before. She stood quietly, enchanted with him, until he looked up suddenly, catching the rapt expression upon her face. She tried not to appear flustered, but even in her own ears, her voice was breathless. I'm sorry to disturb you. I brought some cake for Timmy Graham. I sent him below to join the party. Oh, I didn't notice him. I thought he was here. She made no move to leave, holding the plate in one hand, and they were silent a moment longer. I don't suppose I could interest you in a slice. It's going begging. Share it, he suggested, and she came to the chart table. I owe you an apology, he said, and was immediately aware of the harshness in his own voice. He hated to apologize, and she sensed it. I picked a bad moment, she said, and broke off a piece of the cake. But this seems a better time. Thank you again, and I'm sorry for all the trouble I caused. I understand now that it nearly cost you the Golden Adventurer. They both turned to look at the big armored glass windows to where she lay. She is beautiful, isn't she? Said Nick, and his voice had lost its edge. Yes, she's beautiful, Samantha agreed. And suddenly, they were very close in the intimate ruddy glow of the night lights. He began to talk, stiffly and self-consciously at first. But she drew him on, and with secret joy, she sensed him warming and relaxing. Only then did she begin to put her own ideas forward. Nick was surprised and a little disconcerted at the depth of her view, and at her easy, coherent expression of ideas, for he was still very much aware of her youth. He'd expected the giddiness and the giggle, the shallowness and uninformed self-interest of immaturity. But it was not there. And suddenly, the difference in their ages was of no importance. They were very close in the night, touching only with their minds, but becoming, each minute, so much more closely involved in their ideas that time had no significance. They spoke about the sea, for they were both creatures of that element, and as they discovered this, so their mutual delight in each other grew. From below came the faint, unmelodious strains of Beauty Baker, leading the ship's officers in a chorus of, "The working class can kiss my ass. I've got my 12.5% at last." And at another stage in the evening, a very worried Tim Graham appeared on the bridge and blurted out, "Captain, sir, Dr. Silver is missing. She's not in her cabin and we've said..." He saw her then, sitting in the captain's chair, and his worry turned to consternation. "Oh, I see. We didn't know. I mean, we didn't expect her. I'm sorry, sir. Excuse me, sir. Good night, sir." And again, he fled the bridge. "Doctor?" Nick asked. "I'm afraid so," she smiled. They went on to talk about the university, explaining her research project and the other work she had in mind. Nicholas listened silently, for like all highly competitive and successful men, he respected achievement and ambition. The chasm that he imagined existed between them shrank rapidly, so that it was an intrusion when the 8-12 watch ended and the relief brought other human presence to the bridge, shattering the fragile mood they had created around themselves and denying them further excuse for remaining together. "Good night, Captain Berg," she said. "Good night, Dr. Silver," he answered reluctantly. Until that night, he had not even known her name, and there was so much more he wanted to know now. But she was gone from the bridge. As he entered his own suite, Nick's earlier loneliness returned, but with even more poignancy. During the long day of getting Golden Adventurer under tow, the hours of trim and accommodation to the sea, until she was following meekly, settling down to the long journey ahead, Nick thought of the girl at unlikely moments. But when he changed his usual routine and dined in the saloon rather than in his own cabin, she was surrounded by a solidly attentive phalanx of young men, and with a small shock of self-honesty, Nick realized that he was actually jealous of them. Twice during the meal, he had to suppress the sharp jibes that came to his lips, and would have plunged the unfortunate recipient into uncomprehending confusion. Nick ate no dessert and took coffee alone in his day cabin. He might have relished Beauty Baker's company, but the Australian was aboard Golden Adventurer, working on her main engines. Then, despite the tensions and endeavours of the day, his bunk had no attractions for him. He glanced at the clock on the panelled bulkhead above his desk, and he saw that it was a few minutes after 8 o'clock. On impulse, he went through to the navigation bridge, and Tim Graham leapt guiltily to his feet. He had been sitting in the master's chair, a liberty which deserved at the least a sharp reprimand. But Nick pretended not to notice, and made a slow round of the bridge, checking every detail, from the cable tensions of the tow and power settings of Warlock's engines, to the riding lights on both ships and the last log entry. "Mr. Graham," he said. The young officer stiffened to attention like the victim before a firing squad. "I will stand this watch. You may go and get some dinner." The third officer was so thunderstruck that he needed a large gin before he could bring himself to tell the wardroom of his good fortune. Samantha did not look up from the board, but moved a bishop flauntingly across the front of David Allen's queen. And when David pounced on it with a gurgle of glee, she unleashed her rook from the rear file and said, "Made in three, David." "Once more, Sam. Give me my revenge," pleaded David. But she shook her head and slipped out of the wardroom. Nicholas became aware of the waft of her perfume. It was an inexpensive but exuberant fragrance. Babe, that was it. the one advertised by Hemingway's granddaughter. It suited Samantha perfectly. He turned to her, and it was only then that he was honest enough to admit to himself that he had relieved his third officer with the express intention of luring the girl up onto the bridge. "There are whales ahead," he told her, and smiled one of those rare, irresistible smiles that she had come to treasure. "I hoped you might come up."
"Where? Where are they?"
she asked with unfeigned excitement. And then they both saw the spout, a golden feather of spray in the low night sunlight 2 miles ahead. "Balaenoptera musculus," she exclaimed. "I'll take your word for it, Dr. Silver, but to me it's still a blue whale." Nick was still smiling, and she looked abashed for a moment. "Sorry, I wasn't trying to dazzle you with science." Then she looked back at the humpy, uninviting cold sea as the whale blew again, a far and ethereal column of lonely spray.
"One," she said. "Only one." And the excitement in her voice cooled. "There are so few of them left now. That might be the last one we'll ever see."
"So few, they cannot find each other in the vastness of the ocean to breed." Nick's smile was gone also. And again they talked of the sea, of their own involvement with it, their mutual concern at what man had done to it, and what he was still doing to it. When the Marxist government of Mozambique took over from the Portuguese colonists, it allowed the Soviets to send in dredges, not trawlers, but dredges, and they dredged the weed beds of Delagoa Bay. They actually dredged the breeding grounds of the Mozambique prawn. They took out 1,000 tons of prawn and destroyed the grounds forever, and they drove an entire species into extinction in 6 short months. Her outrage was in her voice as she told it.
2 months ago, the Australians arrested a Japanese trawler in their territorial waters. She had in her freezers the meat of 120,000 giant clams that her crew had torn from the barrier reef with crowbars. The clam population of a single coral reef would not exceed 20,000. That means they had denuded 6 oceanic reefs in one expedition, and they fined the captain £1,000.
"It was the Japanese who perfected the long line," Nick agreed. "The endless floating line, armed with specially designed hooks and laid across the lines of migration of the big pelagic surface-feeding fish, the tuna and the marlin. They wipe out the shoals as they advance. Wipe them out to the last fish."
"You cannot reduce any animal population beyond a certain point."
Samantha seemed much older as she turned her face up to Nick. "Look what they did to the whales." Together, they turned back to the windows, gazing out in hope of another glimpse of that gentle monster, doomed now to extinction. One last look at another creature that would disappear from the seas. "The Japanese and the Russians again," said Nick. "They would not sign the whaling treaty until there were not enough blues left in the seas to make their killing an economic proposition. Then they signed it. When there were 2,000 or 3,000 blue whales left in all the oceans, that is when they signed. Now they will hunt the Finn and the Sei and the Minke to extinction." As they stood side by side, staring into the bizarre, sunlit night, searching vainly for that spark of life in the watery wilderness, without thinking, Nick lifted his arm. He would have placed it around her shoulders, the age-old, protective attitude of man to his woman. But he caught himself at the last moment before he actually touched her. She had felt his movement and tensed for it, swaying slightly towards him in anticipation. But he stepped away, letting his arm fall and stooped over the radar scope. She only realized then how much she had wanted him to touch her. But for the rest of that evening, he stayed within the physical limits which he seemed to have set for himself. The next evening, she declined the wardroom's importunate invitations, and after dinner waited in her own cabin, the door an inch ajar, so she heard Tim Graham leave the bridge, clattering down the companionway with exuberance, relieved once more of this watch. The moment he entered the wardroom, Samantha slipped from her cabin and ran lightly up to the bridge. She was with him only minutes after he had assumed the watch, and Nick was amused by the strength of his pleasure. They grinned at each other like schoolchildren in a successful piece of mischief. Before the light went, they passed close by one of the big tabular bergs, and she pointed out the line of filth that marked the white ice like the ring around a bathtub that had been used by a chimney sweep. Paraffin wax, she said, and undissolved hydrocarbons. No, he said, that's only glacial striation. It's crude oil, she answered him. I've sampled it. It was one of the reasons I took the guide job on Golden Adventurer. I wanted first-hand knowledge of these seas. But we're 2,000 miles south of the tanker lanes. The beach at Shackleton Bay is thick with wax balls and crude droplets. We found oil-soaked penguins on Cape Alarm, dead and dying. They hit an oil slick within 50 miles of that isolated shore. I can hardly believe... Nick started, but she cut across him. That's just it, she said. Nobody wants to believe it. Just walk on by, as though it's another mugging victim lying on the sidewalk. You're right, Nick admitted grudgingly. Very few people really care. A few dead penguins? A few little black tar balls sticking to your feet on the beach? It doesn't seem much to shout about. But it's what we cannot see that should terrify us. Those millions of tons of poisonous hydrocarbons that dissolve into the sea, that kill slowly and insidiously, but surely. That's what should really terrify us, Nicholas. She had used his given name for the first time, and they were both acutely aware of it. They were silent again, staring intently at the big iceberg as it passed slowly. The sun had touched it with ethereal pinks and dreaming amethyst, but that dark line of poisonous filth was still there. The world has to use fossil fuels, and we sailors have to transport them, he said at last. But not at such appalling risks, not with an eye only to profits, not in the same greedy, thoughtless, grabbing, petty way as man wiped out the whale, not at the cost of turning the sea into a stinking, festering cesspool. There are unscrupulous owners, he agreed, and she cut across him angrily, sailing under flags of convenience, without control, ships built to dangerous standards, equipped with a single boiler. She reeled out the charges, and he was silent. Then they waved the winter load line for tankers rounding the Cape of Good Hope in the southern winter to enable them to carry that extra 50,000 tons of crude. The Agulhas Bank, the most dangerous winter sea in the world, and they send overloaded tankers into it. That was criminal, he agreed. Yet you were chairman of Christie Marine. You had a representative on the board of control. She saw that she had made a mistake. His expression was suddenly ferocious. His anger seemed to crackle like electricity in the ruby gloom of the bridge. She felt an unaccountable flutter of real fear. She had forgotten what kind of man he was. But he turned away and made a slow circuit of the bridge, elaborately checking each of the gauges and instruments. And then he paused at the far wing and lit a cheroot. She ached to offer some token of reconciliation, but instinctively she knew not to do so. He was not the kind of man who respected compromise or retreat. He came back to her at last, and the glow of the cheroot lit his features so that she could see the anger had passed. "Christy Marine seems like another existence to me now," he said softly, and she could sense the deep pain of unhealed wounds. "Forgive me. Your reference to it took me off balance. I didn't realize that you knew my past history." "Everybody on board knows." "Of course," he nodded, and drew deeply on the cheroot before he spoke again. "When I ran Christy Marine, I insisted on the highest standards of safety and seamanship for every one of our vessels. We opposed the Cape Winter Line decision, and none of my tankers loaded to their summer line on the Good Hope Passage. None of my tankers made do with only one boiler. The design and engineering of every Christy Marine vessel was of the same standard as that ship there." He pointed back at Golden Adventurer. "Or this one here," and he stamped once on the deck. "Even the Golden Dawn?" she asked softly, braving his anger again, but he merely nodded. "Golden Dawn," he repeated softly. "It sounds such an absurdly presumptuous name, doesn't it? But I really thought of her as that when I conceived her. The first million-ton tanker, with every refinement and safety feature that man has so far tested and proved. From inert gas scrubbers to independently articulated main tanks, not one boiler but four, just like one of the old White Star liners. She was really to be the Golden Dawn of crude oil transportation. However, I am no longer chairman of Christy Marine, and I am no longer in control of Golden Dawn, neither her design nor her construction." His voice was hollow, and in the dim light, his eyes seemed shrunken into their cavities like those of a skull. "Nor yet am I in control of her operation." It was all turning out so badly. She did not want to argue with him, nor make him unhappy. However, she had stirred memories and regrets within him, and she wished vainly that she had not disturbed him so. Her instinct warned her she should leave him now. "Good night, Dr. Silver." He nodded noncommittally at her sudden plea of tiredness. "My name is Sam," she told him, wishing that she could comfort him in some way, anyway. "Or Samantha, if you prefer it." "I do prefer it," he said, without smiling. "Good night, Samantha." She was angry with both herself and him, angry that the good feeling between them had been destroyed. So she flashed at him, "You really are old-fashioned, aren't you?" and hurried from the bridge. The following evening, she almost did not go up to him, for she was ashamed of those parting words, for having pointed out their age difference so offensively. She knew he was sufficiently aware of their differences without being reminded. She had done herself harm, and she did not want to face him again. While she was in the shower of the guest cabin, she heard Tim Graham come clattering down the stairs on the other side of the thin bulkhead. She knew that Nicholas had relieved him. "I'm not going up," she told herself firmly, and took her time drying and talcuming and brushing out her hair before she clambered naked and still pink from the hot water into her bunk. She read for half an hour, a Western that Beauty Baker had lent her, and it required all her concentration to follow the print,
for her mind kept trying to wander. At last, she gave an exclamation of self-disgust, threw back the blankets, and began dressing. His relief and pleasure, when she appeared beside him, were transparent, and his smile was a princely welcome for her. She was suddenly very glad she had come, and this night she effortlessly steered past all the pitfalls. She asked him to explain how the Lloyd's open form contract worked, and she followed his explanation swiftly. If they take into consideration the danger and difficulties involved in the salvage, she mused, you should be able to claim an enormous award. I'm going to ask for 20% of the hull value. What is the hull value of Golden Adventurer? And he told her. She was silent a moment as she checked his mental arithmetic. That's $6 million, she whispered in awe. Give or take a few cents, he agreed. But there isn't that much money in the world. She turned and stared back at the liner. Duncan Alexander is going to agree with you. Nick smiled a little grimly. But, she shook her head, what would anybody do with that amount of money? I'm asking for 6, but I won't get it. I'll walk away with 3 or 4 million. Still, that's too much. Nobody could spend that much, not if they tried for a lifetime. It's spent already. It'll just about enable me to pay off my loans, launch my other tug, and to keep ocean salvage going for another few months. You owe $3 or 4 million? She stared at him now in open wonder. I'd never sleep. Not 1 minute would I be able to sleep. Money isn't for spending, he explained. There's a limit to the amount of food you can eat, or clothes you can wear. Money is a game. The biggest, most exciting game in town. She listened attentively to it all, happy because tonight he was gay and excited with grand designs and future plans, and because he shared them with her. What we will do is this. We'll come down here with both tugs and catch an iceberg. She laughed. Oh, come on. I'm not joking, he assured her, but laughing also. We'll put tow lines on a big berg. It may take a week to build up tow speed, but once we get it moving, nothing will stop it. We will guide it up into the middle 40s, catch the roaring 40s, and just like the old wool clippers on the Australian Passage, we will run our Eastings down. He moved to the chart table, selected a large-scale chart of the Indian Ocean, and beckoned her to join him. You're serious? She stopped laughing and stared at him again. You really are serious, aren't you? He nodded, still smiling, and traced it out with his finger. Then we'll swing northwards, up into the Western Australian current, letting the flow carry us north in a great circle, until we hit the easterly monsoon and the north equatorial current. He described the circle, but she watched his face. They stood very close, but still not touching, and she felt herself stirred by the timbre of his voice, as though to the touch of fingers. We will cross the Indian Ocean to the east coast of Africa, with the current pushing all the way, just in time to catch the southwesterly monsoon drift, right into the Persian Gulf. He straightened up and smiled again. 100 billion tons of fresh water delivered right into the driest and richest corner of the globe. But, she shook her head, it would melt. From a helicopter, we spray it with a reflective polyurethane skin to lessen the effect of the sun, and we moor it in a shallow, specially prepared dock where it will cool of its own surrounds. Sure, it'll melt, but not for a year or two,
and then we'll just go out and catch another one, and bring it in, like roping wild horses.
How would you handle it? She objected. It's too big.
My two tugs hustle 44,000 horses. We could pull in Everest if we wanted.
Yes, but once you get it to the Persian Gulf,
we cut it into manageable hunks with a laser lance and lift the hunks into a melting dam with an overhead crane.
She thought about it.
It could work, she admitted. It will work, he told her. I've sold the idea to the Saudis already. They're already building the dock and the dams. We'll give them water at 1/100th the cost of using nuclear condensers on seawater and without the risk of radioactive contamination.
She was absorbed with his vision, and he with hers, and they talked deep into the long watches of the night. They drew closer in spirit only. Although each of them treasured those shared hours, somehow neither could bridge the narrow chasm between friendliness and real intimacy. She was instinctively aware of his reserves, that he was a man who had considered life and established his code by which to live it. She guessed that he did nothing unless it was deeply felt, and that a casual physical relationship would offer no attraction to him. She knew of the turmoil to which his life had so recently been reduced, and that he was pulling himself out of that by main strength, but that he was now wary of further hurt. There was time, she told herself. Plenty of time. But Warlock bore steadily north by northeast, dragging her crippled ward up through the roaring 40s. Those notorious winds treated her kindly, and she made good the 6 knots that Nick had hoped for. On board Warlock, the attitude of the officers towards Samantha Silver changed from fawning adulation to willful respect. Every one of them knew of the nightly ritual of the 8 to midnight watch. "Bloody cradle snatcher," groused Tim Graham.
"Mr. Graham, it is fortunate I did not hear that remark," David Allen warned him with glacial coldness.
But they all resented Nicholas Berg. It was unfair competition. Yet they kept a new respectful distance from the girl, not one of them daring to challenge the herd bull. The time that Samantha had looked upon as endless was running out now, and she closed her mind to it. Even when David Allen showed her the fuzzy luminescence of the African continent on the extreme range of the radar scheme, she pretended to herself that it would go on like this, if not forever, at least until something special happened. During the long voyage up from Shackleton Bay, Samantha had streamed a very fine meshed net from Warlock's stern, collecting an incredible variety of krill and plankton and other microscopic marine life. Angel had grudgingly given her a small corner of his scullery in return for her services as honorary assistant under chef, an unpaid waitress, and she spent many absorbed hours there each day, identifying and preserving her specimens. She was working there when the helicopter came out to Warlock. She looked up at the buffeting of the machine's rotors as they changed into fine pitch for the landing on Warlock's helideck. And she was tempted to go up like every idle and curious hand on board. But she was in the middle of staining a slide, and somehow she resented the encroachment on this little island of her happiness. She worked on. But now her pleasure was spoiled, and she cocked her head when she heard the roar of the rotors as the helicopter rose from the deck again, and she was left with a sense of foreboding. Angel came in from the deck, wiping his hands on his apron, and he paused in the doorway. You didn't tell me he was going, dearie.
What do you mean?
Samantha looked up at him, startled.
Your boyfriend, darling. Socks and toothbrush and all.
Angel watched her shrewdly. Don't tell me he didn't even kiss you goodbye. She dropped the glass slide into the stainless steel sink, and it snapped in half. She was panting as she gripped the rail of the upper deck and stared after the cumbersome yellow machine. It flew low across the green, wind-chopped sea, humpbacked and nose low, still close enough to read the operating company's name, Cort, emblazoned on its fuselage, but it dwindled swiftly towards the far blue line of mountains. Nick Berg sat in the jump seat between the two pilots of the big S-58T Sikorsky and looked ahead towards the flat silhouette of Table Mountain. It was overlaid by a thick mattress of snowy cloud as the southeasterly wind swirled across its summit. From their altitude of a mere 1,000 feet, there were still 5 big tankers in sight, ploughing stolidly through the green sea on their endless odyssey, seeming to be alien to their element, not designed to live in harmony with it, but to oppose every movement of the waters. Even in this low sea, they wore thick garlands of white as their stubby, rounded bows. And Nick watched one of them dip suddenly and take spray as high as her foremast. In any sort of blow, she would be like a pier with pylons set on solid ground. The seas would break right over her. It was not the way a ship should be. And now he twisted in his seat and looked back. Far behind them, Warlock was still visible. Even at this distance, and despite the fact that she was dwarfed by her charge, her lines pleased the seaman in him. She looked good. But that backward glance invoked a pang of regret that he had been so stubbornly trying to ignore. And he had a vivid image of green eyes and hair of platinum and gold. His regret was spiced by the persistent notion that he'd been cowardly. He had left Warlock without being able to bring himself to say goodbye to the girl, and he knew why he had done so. He would not take the chance of making a fool of himself. He grimaced with distaste as he remembered her exact words. You really are old-fashioned, aren't you? There was something vaguely repulsive in a middle-aged man lusting after young flesh, and he supposed he must now look upon himself as middle-aged. In 6 months, he would be 40 years of age, and he did not really expect to live to 80, so he was in the middle of the road. He'd always scorned those grey, lined, balding, unattractive little men with big cigars, sitting in expensive restaurants with pretty young girls beside them, the young thing pretending to hang on every pearl-like word, while her eyes focused beyond his shoulder on some younger man. But still, it had been cowardice. She had become a friend during those weeks, and she could hardly have been aware of the emotions that she had aroused in him during those long, dark hours on Warlock's Bridge. She was not to blame for his unruly passions. In no way had she encouraged him to believe that he was more than just an older man, not even a father figure, but just someone with whom to pass an otherwise empty hour. She had been as friendly and cheerful to everyone else on board Warlock, from the mate to the cook. He really had owed her the common courtesy of a handshake and an assurance of the pleasure he had taken from her company. But he had not been certain he could restrict it to that. He winced again, as he imagined her horror as he blurted out some sort of declaration, some proposal to prolong their relationship or alter its structure into something more intimate. Her disenchantment, when she realized that behind the facade of the mature and cultured man, he was just as grimy an old lecher as the furtive, drooling browsers in the porno shops of Times Square. Let it go, he had decided. No matter that he was probably in better physical shape now than he'd been at 25. To Dr. Samantha Silver, he was an old man, and he had a frightening vision of an episode from his own youth. A woman, a friend of his mother's, had trapped the 19-year-old Nicholas alone one rainy day in the old beach house at Martha's Vineyard. He remembered his own revulsion at the sagging white flesh, the wrinkles, the lines of stria across her belly and breasts, and the oldness of her. She would then have been a woman of 40, the same as he was now, and he had done her the service she required out of some obligation of pity. But afterwards, he had scrubbed his teeth until the gums bled, and he had stood under the shower for almost an hour. It was one of the cruel deceits of life that a person aged from the outside inwards. He had thought of himself in the fullness of his physical and mental powers, especially now after bringing in Golden Adventurer. He was ready for them to lead on the dragons, and he would tear out their jugulars with his bare hands. Then she had called him an old-fashioned thing, and he had realized that the sexual fantasy, which was slowly becoming an obsession, must be associated with the male menopause, a sorry symptom of the aging process of which he had not been conscious until then. He grinned wryly at the thought. The girl would probably hardly notice that he'd left the ship. At the worst, might be a little piqued by his lack of manners, but in a week would have forgotten his name. As for himself, there was enough, and more than enough, to fill the days ahead. So the image of a slim young body and that precious mane of silver and gold would fade until it became the fairy tale it really was. Resolutely, he turned in the jump seat and looked ahead. Always look ahead. There are never regrets in that direction. They clattered it over False Bay, crossing the narrow isthmus of the Cape Peninsula under the bulk of the cloud-capped mountain, from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic in under 10 minutes. He saw the gathering like vultures at the lion kill, as the Sikorsky lowered to her roost on the helipad within the main harbour area of Table Bay. As Nick jumped down, ducking instinctively under the still-turning rotors, they surged forward, ignoring the efforts of the court-line dispatcher to keep the pad clear. They were led by a big red-faced man with a scorched-looking bald head and the furry arms of a tame bear. "Larry Fry, Mr. Berg," he growled. "You remember me?" "Hello, Larry." He was the local manager for Bark, Wacky and Company, Nick's agents. "I thought you might say a few words to the press." But the journalists swarmed around Nick now, demanding, importuning, jostling each other, their minions firing flashbulbs. Nick felt his irritation flare, and he needed a deep breath and a conscious effort to control his anger. "All right, lads and ladies." He held up both hands and grinned that special boyish grin. They were doing a tough job, he reminded himself. It couldn't be easy to be forced daily into the company of rich and successful men, grabbing for titbits, and being grossly underpaid for your efforts with the long-term expectation of ulcers and cirrhosis of the liver. "Play the game with me, and I'll play it with you," he promised. And thought for the moment how it would be if they didn't want to speak with him. How it would be if they didn't know who he was and didn't care. "Where have you booked me?" he asked Larry Fry now, and turned back to them. "In 2 hours' time, I'll be in my suite at the Mount Nelson Hotel. You're invited, and there'll be whiskey." They laughed and tried a few more half-hearted questions, but they had accepted the compromise. At least, they'd got the pictures. As they went up the palm-lined drive to the gracious old hotel, built in the days when space included 5 acres of carefully groomed gardens, Nick felt the stir of memory. But he suppressed that and listened intently to the list of appointments and matters of urgency from which Larry Fry read. The change in the big man's attitude was dramatic. When Nick had first arrived to take command of Warlock, Larry Fry had given him 10 minutes of his time and sent a deputy to complete the business. Then Nick had been touched by the mark of the beast, a man on his way down, with much appeal as a leper. Larry Fry had accorded him the minimum courtesy due the master of a small vessel, but now he was treating him like visiting royalty, limousine and fawning attention. We've chartered a 707 from South African Airways to fly Golden Adventures passengers to London, and they will take scheduled commercial flights to their separate destinations from there. What about berthing for Golden Adventure? The harbour master is sending out an inspector to check the hull before he lets her enter harbour. You have made the arrangement? Nick asked sharply. He had not completed the salvage until the liner was officially handed over to the company commissioned to undertake the repairs. Court are flying him out now, Larry Fry assured him. We'll have a decision before nightfall. Have the underwriters appointed a contractor for the repairs? They've called for tenders. The hotel manager himself met Nicholas under the entrance portico. Good to see you again, Mr. Berg. He waived the registration procedures. We can do that when Mr. Berg has settled in. And then he assured Nick, we have given you the same suite. Nick would have protested, but already they were ushering him into the sitting room. If it had been a room lacking completely in character or taste, the memories might not have been so poignant. However, unlike one of those soulless plastic and vinyl coupes built by the big chains and so often offered to travellers under the misnomer of inns, this room was furnished with antique furniture, oil paintings and flowers. The memories were as fresh as those flowers, but not as pleasing. The telephone was ringing as they entered, and Larry Fry seized it immediately, while Nick stood in the centre of the room. It had been 2 years since last he'd stood here, but it seemed as many days, so clear was the memory. The harbour master has given permission for Golden Adventurer to enter harbour. Larry Fry grinned triumphantly at Nick and gave him the thumbs-up signal. Nick nodded. The news was an anticlimax after the draining endeavours of the last weeks. Nick walked through to the bedroom. The wallpaper was a quietly tasteful floral design with matching curtains. From the four-poster bed, Nick remembered, you could look out over the lawns. He remembered Chantel sitting under that canopy, with a gossamer sheer bedrobe over her creamy shoulders, eating thin strips of marmaladed toast, and then delicately and carefully licking each slim tapered finger with a pink pointed tongue. Nicholas had come out to negotiate the transportation of South African coal from Richards Bay, and iron core from Saldanha Bay to Japan. He'd insisted that Chantel accompany him. Perhaps he had the premonition of imminent loss, but he'd overridden her objections. But Africa is such a primitive place, Nicky. They have things that bite. And she had in the end gone with him. He had been rewarded with 4 days of rare happiness. The last 4 days ever. For though he did not then even suspect it, he was already sharing her bed and her body with Duncan Alexander. He had never tired in 13 years of that lovely, smooth, creamy body. Rather, he had delighted in its slow, luscious ripening into full womanhood, believing without question that it belonged to him. Chantel was one of those unusual women who grew more beautiful with time. It had always been one of his pleasures to watch her enter a room filled with other internationally acclaimed beauties and see them pale beside his wife. And suddenly, for no good reason, he imagined Samantha Silver beside Chantel. The girl's coltish grace would be transmuted to gawkiness beside Chantel's poise. Her manner as gauche as a schoolgirl's beside Chantel's mature control. A warm, lovable little bunny beside the sleekly beautiful mink. Mr. Berg, London. Larry Fry called from the sitting room, interrupting him, and with relief, Nick picked up the telephone. Just keep going forward, he reminded himself. And before he spoke, he thought again of the two women, and wondered suddenly how much that thick, rich golden mane of Samantha's hair would pale beside Chantel's lustrous sable, and just how much of the mother-of-pearl glow would fade from that young, clear skin. Berg, he said abruptly into the telephone. Mr. Berg, good morning. Will you speak to Mr. Duncan Alexander of Christie Marine? Nick was silent for 5 full seconds. He needed that long to adjust to the name, but Duncan Alexander was the natural extension of his previous thoughts. In the silence, he heard the banging of doors and the rising clamour of voices as journalists converged on the liquor cabinet next door. Mr. Berg, are you there? Yes, he said, and his voice was steady and cool. Put him on. Nicholas, my dear fellow. The voice was glossy as satin, slow as honey, Eton and King's College. £100,000 accent, impossible to imitate. Not quite foppish nor indolent, razor steel in a scabbard of velvet encrusted with golden filigree and precious stones. And Nicholas had seen the steel bared. It seems that it is impossible to hold a good man down. But you tried, young Duncan, Nick answered lightly. Don't feel bad about it. Indeed, you tried. Oh, come, Nicholas. Life is too short for recriminations. This is a new deck of cards. We start equal again. Duncan chuckled softly. At least be gracious enough to accept my congratulations. Accepted, Nicholas agreed. Now, what do we talk about? Is Golden Adventurer in dock yet? She has been cleared to enter. She'll be tied up within 24 hours. And you'd better have your checkbook ready. I hope that we might avoid going up before the committee. There's been too much bitterness already. Let's try and keep it in the family, Nicholas. The family? Christie Marine is the family. You, Chantel, old Arthur Christie, and Peter. It was the very dirtiest form of fighting. And Nick found suddenly that he was shaking like a man in a fever, and that his fist around the receiver was white with the force of his grip. It was the mention of his son that had affected him so. I am not in the family any more. In a way, you'll always be part of it. It's as much your achievement as any man's, and your son...
Nick cut across him brusquely, his voice gravelly. You and Chantel made me a stranger. Now treat me like one.
Nicholas.
Ocean Salvage, as main contractor for the recovery of Golden Adventurer, is open to an offer.
Nicholas.
Make me an offer.
As bluntly as that.
I'm waiting.
Well, now, my board has considered the whole operation in depth, and I am empowered to make you an outright settlement of $750,000.
Nick's tone did not alter. We have been set down for a hearing at Lloyd's on the 27th of next month.
Nicholas, the offer is negotiable within reasonable limits.
You're speaking a foreign language. Nick cut him off. We're so far apart that we're wasting each other's time.
Nicholas, I know how you feel about Christy Marine. You know, the company is underwriting its own.
Now, you really are wasting my time.
Nicholas, it's not a third party. It's not some big insurers consortium. It's Christy Marine.
He used his name again, though it scalded his tongue. Duncan, you're breaking my heart. I'll see you on the 27th of next month at the arbitration court. He dropped the receiver onto its bracket and moved across to the mirror, swiftly combing his hair and composing his features, startled to see how hard and bleak his expression was and how fierce his eyes. However, when he went through to the lounge of the suite, he was relaxed and urbane and smiling.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm all yours.
And one of the ladies of the press, blonde, pretty, and not yet 30, but with eyes as old as life itself, took another sip of her whiskey as she studied him, then murmured huskily, I wouldn't mind at all, Ducky. Golden Adventurer stood tall and very beautiful against the wharf of Cape Town Harbour, waiting her turn to go into the dry dock. Globe Engineering, the contractors who had been appointed to repair her, had signed for her and legally taken over responsibility from Warlock's first officer. But David Allen still felt an immense proprietary pride in her. From Warlock's navigation bridge, he could look across the main harbour basin and see the tall, snowy superstructure glistening in the bright, hot summer sunshine. Towering as high as the giraffe-necked steel wharf cranes, and in gloating self-indulgence, David dwelt on a picture of the liner, wreathed in snow, half obscured by driving sleet and sea fume, staggering in the mountainous black seas off Antarctica. It gave him a solid feeling of achievement, and he thrust his hands deeply into his pockets and whistled softly to himself, smiling and watching the liner.